A couple of bottles from the Loire Valley, the NCO replied with a smile. You want to uncork one and get some glasses out? Cards? John Clark asked. No, I think I'm going to have a glass or two, and then I'm going to get a little sleep. Looks like I have another trip laid on, Sextate told them. Beijing. No surprise, John thought. It won't be Philadelphia, Scott said, as the bottle and glasses arrived. 30 minutes later, all three men pushed their seats back down all the way. The sergeant closed the window shades for them. This time Clark got some sleep, but Chavez did not. There was truth in what Adler had remarked to him. His thesis had savagely attacked turn-of-the-century statesmen for their inability to see beyond immediate problems. Now Ding did know a little better. It was hard to tell the difference between an immediate tactical problem and a truly strategic one when you were dodging the bullets on a minute-to-minute basis, and history books couldn't fully convey the temper, the feel of the times on which they supposedly reported. Not all of it. They also gave the wrong impression of people. Secretary Adler, now snoring in his leather reclining seat, was a career diplomat, Chavez reminded himself, and he'd earned the trust and respect of the president, a man he himself deeply respected. He wasn't stupid. He wasn't venal. But he was merely a man, and men made mistakes. And great men made big ones. Some day some historian would write about this trip they'd just taken. But would that historian really know what it had been like? And, not knowing, how could he really comment on what had taken place? What's going on? Ding asked himself. Iran gets real frisky and knocks over Iraq and starts a new country. And just as America is trying to deal with that, something else happens. An event minor in the great scheme of things, perhaps. But you never knew that until it was all over, did you? How could you tell? That was always the problem. Statesmen over the centuries had made mistakes because when you were stuck in the middle of things, you couldn't step outside and take a more detached look. That's what they were paid to do. But it was pretty hard, wasn't it? He had just finished his master's thesis, and he'd get hooded later this year, and officially proclaimed an expert in international relations. But that was a lie, Ding thought, settling back into his own seat. A flippant observation he'd once made on another long flight came back to him. All too often, international relations was simply one country fucking another. Domingo Chavez, soon to be masters in international relations, smiled at the thought. But it wasn't very funny, really. Not when people got killed. Especially not when he and Mr. C were frontline worker bees. Something happening in the Middle East. Something else happening in China. 4,000 miles away, wasn't it? Could those two things be related? What if they were? But how could you tell? Historians assumed that people could tell, if only they'd been smart enough. But historians didn't have to do the work. Not his best performance, Plummer said, sipping his iced tea. 12 hours, not even that much, to get a handle on something halfway round the world, John, Holtzman suggested. It was a typical Washington restaurant, pseudo-French with cute little tassels on a menu listing overpriced dishes of mediocre quality, but then both men were on expense accounts. He's supposed to handle himself better, Plummer observed. You're complaining that he can't lie effectively? Well, that's one of the things a president is supposed to do. And when we catch him at it, Holtzman didn't have to go on. Whoever said it was supposed to be an easy job, Bob? Sometimes I wonder if we're really supposed to make the job harder. But Plummer didn't bite. Where do you suppose Adler is? The NBC correspondent wondered aloud. That was a good question this morning, the Post reporter granted, lifting his glass. I have somebody looking into that. So do we. All Ryan had to do was say he was preparing to meet with the PRC ambassador. That would have covered things nicely. But it would have been a lie. It would have been the right lie. Bob, that's the game. The government tries to do things in secret, and we try to find out. Ryan likes this secrecy stuff a little too much. But when we burn him for it, whose agenda are we following? What do you mean? Come on, John. Ed Keelty leaked all that stuff to you. I don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that one out. Everybody knows it. Bob picked at his salad. It's all true, isn't it? Yes, it is, Holtzman admitted. And there's a lot more.
Really?
Well, I know you had a story working. He didn't add that he was sorry to have scooped the younger man, mainly because he wasn't. Even more than I can write about.
Really?
That got John Plummer's attention. Holtzman was one of the younger generation in relation to the TV correspondent, and one of the older generation for the newest class of reporters, which regarded Plummer as a fuddy-duddy, even as they attended his seminars at Columbia University's journalism program.
Really? Bob assured him.
Like?
Like things that I can't write about, Holtzman repeated.
Not for a long time, anyway. John, I've been on part of this story for years. I know the CIA officer who got Gerasimov's wife and daughter out. We have a little deal. In a couple years, he tells me how it was done. The submarine story is true, and...
I know.
I've seen a photograph of Ryan on the boat. Why he doesn't let that one leak is beyond me.
He doesn't break the rules. Nobody ever explained to him that it's okay to do that.
He needs more time with Arnie.
As opposed to Ed.
Keelty knows how the game is played.
Yes, he does, John, maybe a little too well.
You know, there's one thing I've never quite been able to figure out, Bob Holtzman remarked.
What's that?
The game we're in, are we supposed to be spectators, referees, or players?
Bob, our job is to report the truth to our readers.
Well, viewers for me.
Whose facts, John? Holtzman asked.
A flustered and angry President Jack Ryan. Jack picked up the remote and muted the CNN reporter who'd zapped him with the China question.
Angry, yes. Flustered, no.
Also, yes, Van Damme said. You bungled the thing on China, and where Adler is.
Where is he, by the way?
The president checked his watch. He should be getting into Andrews in about 90 minutes. Probably over Canada now, I guess. He comes straight here and then probably off again to China.
What the hell are they up to?
You got me, the chief of staff admitted. But that's why you have a national security team.
I know as much as they do, and I don't know shit, Jack breathed, leaning back in his chair.
We've got to increase our human intelligence capability. The president can't be stuck here all the time not knowing what's going on. I can't make decisions without information, and all we have now are guesses, except for what Robbie told us. That's a hard data point, but it doesn't make sense because it doesn't fit in with anything else.
You have to learn to wait, Mr. President.
Even if the press doesn't, you do. And you have to learn to focus on what you can do when you can do it.
Now, Arnie went on, we have the first set of House elections coming up next week. We have you scheduled to go out and make speeches. If you want the right kind of people in Congress, then that's what you have to go out and do. I have Callie preparing a couple of speeches for you.
What's the focus?
Tax policy, management improvement, integrity, all your favorites. We'll have the drafts to you tomorrow morning. Time to spend some more time out among the people. Let them love you some, and you can love them back some more.
The chief of staff earned himself a wry look.
I've told you before, you can't be trapped in here, and the radios on the airplane work just fine.
A change of scenery would be nice, POTUS admitted.
You know what would really be good now?
What's that?
Arnie grinned.
A natural disaster. Gives you the chance to fly out and look presidential, meet people, console them and promise federal disaster relief and...
God damn it!
It was so loud the secretaries heard it through the 3-inch door.
Arnie sighed.
You gotta learn to take a joke, Jack. Put that temper of yours in a box and lock it the hell up. I just set you off for fun, and I'm on your side, remember?
Arnie headed back to his office, and the president was alone again.
Yet another lesson in Presidency 101. Jack wondered when they would stop. Sooner or later,
He'd have to act presidential, wouldn't he? But he hadn't quite made it yet. Arnie hadn't said that exactly, and neither had Robbie. But they didn't have to. He still didn't belong. He was doing his best, but his best wasn't good enough. Yet, his mind added. Yet. Maybe never. One thing at a time, he thought. What every father said to every son, except they never warned you that one at a time was a luxury some people couldn't afford. 14 dead Americans on a runway, on an island 8,000 miles away. Killed on purpose, probably. For a purpose he could scarcely guess at. And he was supposed to set that fact aside and get on with other things. Like a trip back out to meet the people he was supposed to preserve, protect, and defend. Even as he tried to figure out how he'd failed to do so for 14 of them. What was it you needed in order to do this job? Turn off dead citizens and fix on other things? You had to be a sociopath to accomplish that, didn't you? Well, no. Others had to. Doctors, soldiers, cops. And now him. And control his temper, salve his frustration, and focus on something else for the rest of the day. Movie Star looked down at the sea, 6 kilometers below, he estimated. To the north he could see an iceberg on the blue-gray surface, glistening in the bright sunlight. Wasn't that remarkable? As often as he'd flown, he'd never seen one of those before. For someone from his part of the world, the sea was strange enough, like a desert, impossible to live on, though a different way. Strange how it looked, like the desert in all but color. The surface crinkling in almost regular parallel lines, just like dunes, but uninvitingly. Despite his looks, about which he was quite vain, he liked the smiles he got from flight attendants, for example. Almost nothing was inviting to him. The world hated him and his kind. Even those who made use of his services preferred to keep him at arm's length, like a vicious but occasionally useful dog. He grimaced, looking down. Dogs were not favored animals in his culture. And so here he was, back on another airplane, alone, with his people on another aircraft in groups of 3, heading to a place where they would be decidedly not welcome, sent from a place where they were scarcely more so. Success would bring him what? Intelligence officers would seek to identify and track him. But the Israelis had been doing that for years, and he was still alive. What was he doing this for? Movie Star asked himself. It was a little late for that. If he canceled the mission, then he wouldn't be welcome anywhere at all. He was supposed to be fighting for Allah, wasn't he? Jihad. A holy war. It was a religious term for a military religious act. One meant to protect the faith. But he didn't really believe that anymore. And it was vaguely frightening to have no country, no home, and then no faith. Did he even have that anymore, he asked himself, then admitted that if he had to ask, he didn't. He and his kind, at least the ones who survived, became automatons, skilled robots, computers in the modern age, machines that did things at the bidding of others, to be thrown away when convenient, and below him the surface of the sea or the desert never changed. Yet he had no choice. Perhaps the people who were sending him on the mission would win, and he would have some sort of reward. He kept telling himself that, after all, even though there was nothing in his living experience to support the belief, and if he'd lost his faith in God, then why was it that he could remain faithful to a profession that even his employers regarded with distaste? Children. He'd never married. Never fathered one, to his knowledge. The women he'd had, perhaps. But no, they were debauched women. And his religious training had taught him to despise them even as he made use of their bodies. And if they produced offspring, then the children, too, would be cursed. How was it that a man could chase an idea for all his life and then realize that here he was, looking down at the most inhospitable of scenes, a place where neither he nor any man could live, and be more at home here than any place else? And so he would assist in the deaths of children, unbelievers, political expressions, things. But they were not. They were innocent of any guilt at that age, their bodies not yet formed, their minds not yet taught the nature of good and evil. Movie star told himself that such thoughts had come to him before, that doubts were normal to men on difficult tasks, and that each previous time he'd set them aside and gotten on with it. If the world had changed, then perhaps... But the only changes that had taken place were contrary to his lifelong quest. And was it that, having killed for nothing, he had to keep killing in the hope of achieving something? Where did that path lead? If there were a God, and there were a faith, and there were a law, then... Well, he had to believe in something. He checked his watch. 4 more hours. He had a mission. He had to believe in that. They came by car instead of helicopter. Helicopters were too visible, and maybe this way nobody would notice. To make things more covert still, the cars came to the East Wing entrance. Adler, Clark, and Chavez walked into the White House the same way Jack had on his first night, hustled along by the Secret Service, and they managed to arrive unseen by the press. The Oval Office was a little crowded. Goodley and the Foleys were there as well, along with Arnie, of course. "How's the jet lag, Scott?" Jack asked first, meeting him at the door. "If it's Tuesday, it must be Washington," the Secretary of State replied. "It isn't Tuesday," Goodley observed, not getting it. "Then I guess the jet lag is pretty bad." Adler took his seat and brought out his notes. A Navy mess steward came in with coffee, the fuel of Washington. The arrivals from the UIR all had a cup. "Tell us about Darii," Ryan commanded. "He looks healthy. A little tired," Adler allowed. "His desk is fairly clean." He spoke quietly, but he's never been one to raise his voice in public, to the best of my knowledge. "Interestingly, he was getting into town about the same time we were." "Oh," Ed Foley said, looking up from some of his own notes. "Yeah, he came in on a business jet, a Gulfstream," Clark reported. "Ding got a few pictures." "So he's hopping around some?" "I guess that makes sense," POTUS observed. Strangely, Ryan could identify with Darii's problems. They weren't all that different from his own, though the Iranians' methods could hardly have been more different. "His staff's afraid of him," Chavez added impulsively, "like something from an old World War II Nazi movie. The staff in his outer office was pretty wired. If somebody had yelled, 'Boo,' they would have hit the ceiling." "I'd agree with that," Adler said, not vexed at the interruption. "His demeanor with me was very old world, quiet, platitudes, that sort of thing. The fact of the matter is that he said nothing of real significance, maybe good, maybe bad. He's willing to have continued contacts with us. He says he desires peace for everybody. He even hinted at a certain degree of goodwill for Israel. For a lot of the meeting, he lectured me on how peaceful he and his religion are. He emphasized the value of oil and the resulting commercial relationships for all parties involved. He denied having any territorial ambitions. No surprises in any of it." "Okay," the president said. "What about body language?" "He appears very confident, very secure. He likes where he is now." "As he well might." It was Ed Foley again. Adler nodded. "Agreed. If I had to describe him in one word, it would be serene." "When I met him a few years ago," Jack remembered, "he was aggressive, hostile, looking for enemies, that sort of thing." "None of that earlier today." Sextate stopped and asked himself if it was still the same day. Probably, he decided. "Like I said, serene, but then on the way back, Mr. Clark here brought something up."
"What's that?" Goodley asked.
"It set off the metal detector." John pulled the necklace out again and handed it to the president.
"Get some shopping done?"
"Well, everybody wanted me to do a walkabout," he reminded his audience. "What better place than a market?" Clark went on to report the incident with the goldsmith, while POTUS examined the necklace.
"If he sells these things for $700, maybe we should all get his address."
"Isolated incident, John?"
"The French station chief was walking with me. He said that this guy was pretty representative." So? Van Damme asked.
So maybe Darii doesn't have much to be all that serene about, Scott Adler suggested.
People like that don't always know what the peasants are thinking, the chief of staff thought.
Well, that's what brought the Shah down, Ed Foley told him. And Darii is one of the people who made that happen. I don't think it's likely that he's forgotten that particular lesson. And we know that he's still cracking down on people who step out of line.
The DCI turned to look at his field officer.
Good one, John.
Lefebvre, the French spook, told me twice that we don't have a very good feel for the mood in the street over there.
Maybe he was shining me on, Clark continued. But I don't think so.
We know there's dissent. There always is, Ben Goodley said.
But we don't know how much. It was Adler again.
On the whole, I think we have a man here who wants to project serenity for a reason. He's had a couple of good months. He's knocked over a major enemy. He has some internal problems whose magnitude we need to evaluate. He's hopping back and forth to Iraq. We saw that. He's tired-looking. Tense staff. I'd say he has a full plate right now.
Okay, he told me how he wants peace. I almost buy it. I think he needs time to consolidate. Clark here tells me that food prices are high.
That's an inherently rich country, and Darii can best quiet things down by playing on his political success and turning that into economic success as quickly as possible. Putting food on the table won't hurt. For the moment, he needs to look in instead of looking out.
So I think it's possible that we have a window of opportunity here, Sextate concluded.
Extend the open hand of friendship? Arnie asked.
I think we can keep the contacts quiet and informal for the time being. I can pick somebody to handle the meetings, and then we see what develops.
The president nodded.
Good one, Scott.
Now I guess we'd better get you up to speed on China.
When do I leave? Sextate inquired with a pained expression.
You'll have a bigger airplane this time, his president promised him.
Chapter 41 Hyenas.
Movie star felt the main landing gear thump down at Dulles International Airport. The physical sensation didn't exactly end his doubts, but it did announce that it was time to put them aside. He lived in a practical world. The entry routine was routine again.
Back so soon? The immigration officer asked, flipping to the last entry in the passport.
Ja, doch, movie star replied in his German identity. Perhaps I get apartment here soon.
The prices in Washington are kind of steep, the man reported, stamping the booklet yet again.
Have a pleasant stay, sir.
Thank you.
It wasn't that he had anything to fear. He was carrying nothing illegal except what was in his head, and he knew that American intelligence had virtually never caused substantive harm to a terrorist group. But this trip was different, even if only he knew it, as he walked alone in the mob of the terminal. As before, no one would meet him. They had a rendezvous to which he would be the last to arrive. He was more valuable than the other members of the team. Again he rented a car, and again he drove toward Washington, checking his mirror, taking the wrong exit deliberately and watching to see if anyone followed as he reversed direction to get back on the proper road. Again as before, the coast was clear. If there were anyone on him, the coverage was so sophisticated that he had no chance at all to survive. He knew how that worked. Multiple cars, even a helicopter or two. But such an investment of time and resources only happened if the opposition knew nearly everything. It took time to organize, and that could only mean deep penetration of his group by the American CIA. The Israelis were capable of such a thing, or so everyone in the terrorist movement feared. But over the years a brutally Darwinian process had ended the lives of all the careless men. The Israeli Mossad had never once blanched at the sight of Islamic blood, and had he been discovered by that agency, he would long since have been dead. Or that's what he told himself, still watching his rearview mirror because that was how he stayed alive. On the other hand, it amused him greatly that this mission would not have been possible without the Israelis. Islamic terrorist groups existed in America, but they had all the hallmarks of amateurs. They were overtly religious. They held meetings in known places. They talked among themselves. They could be seen, spotted, and positively identified as being different from the other fish in their adopted sea. And then they wondered how they were caught. Fools, movie star thought. But they served their purpose. In being visible, they attracted attention, and the American FBI had only so many assets. However formidable the world's intelligence services, they were also human institutions, and humans universally pounded on the nails that stuck up. Israel had taught him that after a fashion. Before the fall of the Shah, his own intelligence service, the SAVAK, had received training from the Israeli Mossad, and not all SAVAK members had been executed with the arrival of the new Islamic regime. The tradecraft, they'd learned, had also been taught to those like Movie Star, and the truth of the matter was that it was very easy to understand. The more important the mission, the more caution was required. If you wanted to avoid being spotted, then you had to disappear into your surroundings. In a secular country, do not be obviously devout. In a Christian and Jewish country, do not be Muslim. In a nation that had learned to distrust people from the Middle East, be from somewhere else. Or better yet, on occasion, be truthful after a fashion. Yes, I come from there, but I am a Christian, or a Baha'i, or a Kurd, or an Armenian. And they persecuted my family cruelly. And so I came to America, the land of opportunity, to experience true freedom. And if you followed those simple rules, the opportunity was quite real, for America made it so easy. This country welcomed foreigners with an openness that reminded Movie Star of his own culture's stern law of hospitality. Here he was in the camp of his enemy, and his doubts faded, as the exhilaration of it increased his heart rate and brought a smile to his face. He was the best at what he did. The Israelis, having trained him at second hand, had never gotten close to him. And if they couldn't, then neither could the Americans. You just had to be careful. In each team of three, there was one man like him, not quite as experienced as he was, but close enough, able to rent a car and drive safely, to know to be polite and friendly with all he met. If a policeman were to stop him, he knew to be contrite and apologetic, to ask what he'd done wrong, and then ask for directions, because people remembered hostility more clearly than amity. To profess to be a physician or engineer or something else respectable, it was easy if you were careful. Movie Star reached his first destination, a middle-level hotel on the outskirts of Annapolis, and checked in under his cover name Dieter Kolb. The Americans were so foolish. Even their police thought that all Muslims were Arabs, never remembering that Iran was an Aryan country, the very same ethnic identity which Hitler had claimed for his nation. He went to his room and checked his watch. If everything went according to plan, they would meet in 2 hours. To be sure, he placed a call to the 1-800 numbers for the proper airlines, and inquired about arriving flights. They'd all arrived on time. There might have been a problem with customs or bad traffic, but the plan had allowed for that. It was a cautious one. They were already on the road for their next stop, which was Atlantic City, New Jersey, where there was a huge convention center. The various new model and concept cars were wrapped in covers to protect their finish, most of them on conventional auto trailers, but a few in covered trailers like those used by racing teams.
One of the manufacturer's representatives was going over handwritten comments his company had solicited from people who'd stopped by to look at their products. The man rubbed his eyes. Damned headache. Sniffles. He hoped he wasn't coming down with something. Achy, too. That's what you got for standing around all day right under the air conditioning vent. The official telegram was hardly unexpected. The American Secretary of State requested an official consultation with his government to discuss matters of mutual interest. Zhang knew there was no avoiding this, and all the better to receive him in a friendly way, protesting innocence, and inquiring delicately if the American president had merely misspoken himself or had changed long-standing U.S. policy at his press conference. That side issue alone would tie up Adler for some hours, he imagined. The American would probably offer to be an intermediary between Beijing and Taipei, to shuttle back and forth between the two cities, hoping to calm things down. That would be very useful. For the moment, the exercises were continuing, albeit with somewhat greater respect for the neutral space between the two sets of forces. The heat was still on, but at the simmer setting. The People's Republic, the ambassador had already explained in Washington, had done nothing wrong, had not fired the first shot, and had no desire to initiate hostilities. The problem was with the breakaway province, and if only America would accede to the obvious solution to the problem, there is one China, then the matter would be settled, and quickly. But America had long held to a policy that made sense to none of the countries involved, wanting to be friendly with Beijing and Taipei, treating the latter as the lesser nation it was, but unwilling to take that to its logical conclusion. Instead, America said that, yes, there was only one China, but that the one China did not have the right to enforce its rule on the other China, which, according to official American policy, didn't actually exist. Such was American consistency. It would be such a pleasure to point this out to Secretary Adler. The People's Republic is pleased to welcome Secretary Adler in the interests of peace and regional stability. Well, isn't that nice of them, Ryan said, still in his office at 9 in the evening, and wondering what TV his kids were watching without him. He handed the message back to Adler. You're really sure they did it? Sextate asked Admiral Jackson. If I go over it any more, the tape will wear out. You know, sometimes people just screw up. Sir, this is not one of those times, Robbie said, wondering if he'd have to run the videotape again. And they've been exercising their fleet for quite a while now. Oh? Ryan asked. To the point that they must be wearing things out by now. They're not as good on maintenance as we are. Besides that, they're using up a lot of fuel. This is the most at-sea time we've ever seen them do. Why are they stringing things out? This shoot-down looks to me like a great excuse to call it a day and head back to port and say they've made their point. National pride, Adler suggested. Face-saving. Well, since then, they've curtailed operations somewhat. Not approaching the line I showed you. The Taiwanese are really at full alert now. Hell, maybe that's it. The J-3 opined. You don't attack a pissed-off enemy. You let him relax some first. Rob, you said that a real attack isn't possible, Ryan said. Jack, in the absence of knowledge of their intentions, I have to go by capabilities. They can stage a major engagement in the Strait, and they will probably come off winners if they do. Maybe that will put sufficient political pressure on Taiwan to force some sort of major concession. They killed people, Jackson reminded the other two. Sure, the value they place on human life isn't the same as ours, but when you kill people, you cross another invisible line. And they know how we feel about that. Move the carrier up, Adler said. Why, Scott? Mr. President, it gives me a face card to lay on the table. It shows that we're taking this seriously. As Admiral Jackson just told us, we do take the loss of life seriously, and they will just have to accept the fact that we don't want and might not allow this to go any further. What if they press anyway? What if there's another accident that might involve us? Mr. President, that's operations, and that's my business. We'd park Ike on the east side of the island. They can't get to her by accident, then. They'd have to come through three defense belts to do so, the Rock one over the Strait, then Taiwan itself, and then the wall the battle group commander puts up. I could also spot an Aegis at the bottom end of the strait to give us full radar coverage of the entire passage. If, that is, you order us to move Ike. The advantage for Taiwan? Well, 4 squadrons of fighters, plus airborne radar coverage. That should make them feel more secure. Which will allow me to play a better game if I shuttle back and forth, the secretary concluded. But that still leaves the I.O. uncovered. It's been a long time since we did that. Robbie kept coming back to that, the other two noticed. Nothing else there? Jack asked. He realized that he should have found out before. A cruiser, Anzio, 2 destroyers, plus 2 frigates guarding an underway replenishment group based at Diego Garcia. We never leave Diego uncovered by warships, not with the pre-positioning ships there. We have a 688-class sub in the area, too. It's enough to matter, but not enough to project power. Mr. Adler, you understand what a carrier means. Sextate nodded. People take them seriously. That's why I think we need it off China. He makes a good case, Rob. Where is Ike now? Between Australia and Sumatra. Should be approaching the Sunda Strait. Exercise Southern Cup is supposed to simulate an Indian attack on their northwest coast. If we move her now, she can beat a Formosa in 4 days plus a couple hours. Get her moving that way, Rob, all possible speed. Aye, aye, sir, Jackson acknowledged, his doubt still visible on his face. He gestured to the phone, and getting a nod, he called the National Military Command Center. This is Admiral Jackson with orders from National Command Authority. Execute Greyhound Blue. Acknowledge that, Colonel. Robbie listened and nodded. Very well, thank you. Then he turned to his president. Okay, Ike will turn north in about 10 minutes and make a speed run to Taiwan. That fast? Adler allowed himself to be impressed. The miracle of modern communications. And we already had alert orders to Admiral Dubrow. This won't be a covert move. The battle group will head through several narrows, and people will notice, he warned. Press release won't hurt, Adler said. We've done it before. Well, there's your card to play in Beijing and Taipei, Ryan said, having exercised yet another executive order, but distantly concerned that Robbie was unhappy about it. The really difficult matter was fuel. A fleet replenishment group would have to move as well, to refill the bunkers of Eisenhower's non-nuclear escort ships. Will you let on that we know about the shoot-down? Adler shook his head. No, definitely not. It will be more unsettling to them if they think we don't know. Oh? This came from a somewhat surprised president. Then I can decide when we find out, boss. And when that happens, I have another card to play. That way I can make it a big card. He turned. Admiral, don't overestimate the intelligence of your enemy. Diplomats like me aren't all that savvy on the technical aspects of what you do. That applies to people in foreign countries, too. A lot of our capabilities are unknown to them. They have spooks to keep them informed, Jackson objected. You think they always listen? Do we? The J-3 blinked at that lesson and filed it away for future use. It happened in a large shopping mall, an American invention that seemed designed for covert operations, with its many entrances, bustling people, and near-perfect anonymity. The first rendezvous wasn't really a meeting at all. Nothing more than eye contact was made, and that not at a distance closer than 10 meters, as the groups strolled past one another. Instead, each of the subgroups performed a count, confirmed identity visually, and then each checked to be sure that there was no surveillance on the others. With that done, they all returned to their hotel accommodations. The real rendezvous would take place tomorrow. Movistar was pleased. The sheer audacity of this was very exciting indeed. This wasn't the relatively simple task of getting one bomb-clad fool, heroic martyr, he corrected himself, into Israel. And the beauty of it was that, had one of his teams been spotted, the enemy couldn't possibly risk ignoring them. You could force the opposition into showing its hand, and so much the better to do it at a point in time when none of your people had done anything more than enter the country with false travel documents. Doubts be damned, the leader of the operation told himself. There was the sheer beauty of being ready to do something right in the lion's own den, and that was what kept him in the business of terrorism. In the lion's own den, he smiled at the cars as he walked across the parking lot. The lion's own cubs.
"So what are you doing?" Kathy asked in the dark.
"Scott leaves for China tomorrow morning," Jack answered, lying next to his wife. People said that the President of the United States was the world's most powerful man. But at the end of every day, the exercise of that power surely seemed to exhaust him. Even his time at Langley, with an auto commute each way every day, hadn't worn him out as this job did.
"To say what?"
"Try to get them calmed down, defuse the situation."
"You're really sure that they deliberately—"
"Yes. Robbie is positive, about as much as you are with a diagnosis," her husband confirmed, staring up at the ceiling.
"And we are going to negotiate with them?" Surgeon asked.
"Have to.
But,
honey, sometimes—hell, most of the time—a nation-state commits murder. They get away with it. I'm supposed to think about the big picture, the larger issues, and all that stuff."
"That's awful," Kathy told him.
"Yes, it sure is. This game you have to play by its own rules. If you mess up, more people suffer. You can't talk to a nation-state the way you talk to a criminal. There are thousands of Americans over there, businessmen and like that. If I get too far out of line, then things might happen to some of them. And then things escalate and get worse," POTUS explained to her.
"What's worse than killing people?" his physician wife asked.
Jack didn't have an answer. He'd come to accept the fact that he didn't have all the answers for press conferences, or for all the people out there, or even for his own staff sometimes. Now he didn't even have a single answer for his wife's simple and logical question. "Most powerful man in the world?" "Sure." With that thought, another day ended at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Even important people got careless, an eventuality made easier by a little creativity on the part of more careful folk. The National Reconnaissance Office was working hard to keep track of two places. Every pass of the reconsats over the Middle East, and now the Formosa Strait, resulted in copious numbers of download pictures, literally thousands of images which photo interpretation specialists had to examine one by one in their new building close to Dulles Airport. It was just one more task that couldn't be done by computer. The readiness of the UIR military had become the number one priority item for the American government, as part of the Special National Intelligence Estimate, now in preparation on White House orders. That meant the entire attention of the team fell that way, and, for the other things, more people were called in to work overtime. These looked continuously at the photos downloaded from over China. If the PRC was going to make a real military move, then it would show in many ways. People's Liberation Army troops would be out training and maintaining their equipment, or loading their tanks onto trains, and the parking areas would look different. Aircraft would have weapons hanging from their wings. These were things a satellite photo would reveal. More care was taken to spot ships at sea. That was far harder, since they were not in fixed locations. America still had three photographic satellites aloft, each making two passes per day over the areas of interest, and they were spaced so that there was little sad time. That made the technicians feel pretty good about things. They had a continuous feed of data with which to firm up their estimates and so do their duty for their president and their country.
But they couldn't watch everything everywhere, and one place they didn't watch was Bombay, western headquarters of the Indian Navy. The orbits of the American KH-11 satellites were well-defined, as were their schedules. Just after the newest satellite swept over the area, with the other new one on the far side of the world, came a 4-hour window, which would end with the overhead passage of the oldest and least reliable of the trio. Happily, it also coincided with a high tide. Two carriers, their repairs recently completed, and their escorts, slipped their mooring lines and stood out to sea. They would be conducting training exercises in the Arabian Sea, in case anyone noticed and asked about it.
Damn.
The Cobra representative woke up, feeling a little feverish. It took him a few seconds to orient himself. Different motel, different city, different room lights. He fumbled for the proper switch, then put on his glasses, squinting in the uncomfortable light, and spotted his bag. Yeah, shaving kit. He took that into the bathroom, pulled the paper cover off the glass, and half-filled it with water. Then he worked the child-proof top on the aspirin bottle, tipped 2 tablets into his hand, and washed them down. He ought not to have had all those beers after dinner, the sales rep told himself, but he'd made a fairly decent deal with a couple of club pros, and beer was always a good lubricant for the golf business. He'd feel better in the morning. A former touring professional who hadn't been quite good enough to make it big, he was now a very successful manufacturer's representative. What the hell, he thought, heading back to his bed. He still had a minus handicap, the pace was easier, and he was making a pretty good living, plus being able to play a new course practically every week, the better to demonstrate his wares. He hoped the aspirin would work. He had an 8:30 tea time. Storm Track and Palm Bowl were connected by a fiber-optic communications cable, the better to share information. Another training exercise was underway in the former Iraq, and this one wasn't a CPX. The 3 heavy corps of integrated Iraqi and Iranian units were in the field. Direction-finding radios placed them well away from the Saudi and Kuwaiti borders, and so no special danger was attached to their activities. But the Elint troops were listening closely to get a feel for the skill level of the commanders who were moving tanks and infantry fighting vehicles across the broad, dry plains southeast of Baghdad. "Here's good news, Major," the American lieutenant said, handing over a telex. The UIR SNI had generated something positive for a change. 200 miles northwest of Kuwait, at a spot 5 miles south of the berm, actually a man-made dune, that marked the border between the kingdom and the UIR, a deuce and a half truck stopped. The crew got out, attached the extension to the launch ramp, and fired up their Predator drone. But drone was an obsolete term. This mini aircraft was an unmanned aerial vehicle, or UAV, a blue-gray-colored, propeller-driven spy. It took about 20 minutes to attach the wings, run diagnostics on the electronics, and spin up the engine. And then it was launched, the annoying buzz of its engine fading rapidly as it climbed to its operating altitude and headed north. The product of 3 decades of research, Predator was fairly stealthy, difficult to detect on radar due to its small size, the inclusion of radar-absorbing material in its design, and the fact that its operating speed was so slow that modern computer-controlled radars, if they caught it at all, classified it as a bird and erased it from the operator's scope. The paint covering the airframe was the same IR-suppressive product the Navy had taken to using. It was both ugly and prone to provide a sticky home to anything that touched it. The technicians had to brush sand off their baby all the time. But that was balanced by the fact that the color blended in with the sky exceedingly well. Armed only with a TV camera, this one soared up to 10,000 feet and cruised north under the control of another team at Storm Track, the better to keep an eye on the UIR exercises. It was a technical violation of the new country's sovereignty, but 2 pounds of explosive in the UAV would ensure that if it hit the ground in the wrong place, no one would be able to tell what it was. A directional antenna beamed the take from the camera to receivers in the kingdom. The fiber-optic data link cross-loaded the same signal to Palm Bowl, and when a USAF-enlisted woman switched on the room's monitor, they were looking down at a nearly featureless landscape while the Predator was guided to its destination by its operators.
"It'll be good to see if they know what they're doing," the lieutenant observed to Major Sabah.
"Better if we see that they don't," the Kuwaiti officer replied thoughtfully.
Other members of his extended family were increasingly concerned. Enough so, the major thought, that their country's military was quietly ramping up to a very high state of readiness. Like the Saudis, the Kuwaiti citizens who'd flocked enthusiastically to man the best equipment that their small but wealthy country could obtain felt that maintenance of their tanks was a task for lesser men. But unlike their Saudi cousins, they had experience with being on the bottom side of conquest. Many of them had lost family members, and a long memory was characteristic of this part of the world. For that reason, they trained with a will. They weren't yet near the level of the Americans who taught them, or the Israelis who held them in distant contempt, Major Sabah knew. His countrymen had first of all learned how to shoot. They'd burned out at least one gun tube per tank in the pure joy of learning that skill. And they had been firing real rounds, not just practice. War shots fly straighter and farther, as they combined a diverting hobby with a national survival skill. Able now to hit their targets, their current task was to learn to maneuver and fight on the move. Again, they couldn't do it well, not yet, but they were learning. The developing crisis put emphasis on their training, and even now his countrymen were leaving their banking, oil, and trading offices to mount their vehicles. An American advisory team would take them into the field again, give them a battle problem, and watch their performance. While it pained the major that his countrymen, many of them relatives, were not yet ready, it was a source of pride to him that they were making a real effort. Bright as he was, however, it never occurred to him how close his military was to the Israeli model, citizen soldiers learning to fight after the harsh lesson of not having known.
"Swordsman is awake," Andrea Price heard in her earpiece. They were in the kitchen, the detail commander with her sub-detail chiefs, standing and sipping coffee around one of the stainless steel countertops used for preparing food.
"Roy?"
"Another routine day," Special Agent Altman said.
"She's got 3 procedures scheduled for the morning, then a lecture to some Spanish docs in the afternoon. University of Barcelona, 10 of them, 8 males, 2 females. We checked the names with the Spanish police. They're all clean. No special threats reported against surgeon. Looks like a normal day at the office."
"Mike?" she asked Special Agent Michael Brennan, principal agent to Little Jack.
"Well, shortstop has a first period biology test today and baseball practice after school. Pretty good with a glove, but his batting needs help," the agent added. "Otherwise, same-o, same-o."
"Wendy?"
Special Agent Gwendolyn Merritt was principal agent for Sally Ryan. "Chemistry exam for Shadow in third period today. She's getting very interested in Kenny. Nice kid, needs a haircut and a new tie. She's thinking about going out for the girls' lacrosse team." A few faces winced at that revelation. "How do you protect someone being chased by teenagers with sticks?"
"What's the family background on Master Kenny again?" Price asked. Even she couldn't remember everything.
"Father and mother, both lawyers. Tax stuff, mainly."
"Shadow needs better taste," Brennan observed to general amusement around the counter. "He was the joker of the crew."
"There is a potential threat there, Wendy."
"Huh? What?"
"If POTUS gets the new tax laws passed, they're in the shitter."
Andrea Price made another checkmark on her morning list.
"Don?"
"Today's routine is the same as usual, introductory crayon. I'm still not happy with the setup, Andrea. I want some more people, one more inside and two more for overwatch on the south side, Don Russell announced. We're too exposed. We just don't have enough defensive depth there. The outer perimeter is essentially the only one, and I am not comfortable with that.
Surgeon doesn't want us to overpower the place. You have yourself and two agents inside, three for immediate backup, and one surveillance agent across the road, Price reminded him.
Andrea, I want three more. We're too exposed there, Russell repeated. His voice was reasonable and professional as ever. The family has to listen to us on professional questions.
How about I come over tomorrow afternoon to look things over again, Price asked. If I agree, then I go to the boss.
Fine. Special Agent Russell nodded.
Any more problems with Mrs. Walker?
Sheila tried to get a petition drive started with the other Giant Steps parents. Get Sandbox out of there, that sort of thing. It turns out that Mrs. Daggett gets a lot of repeat business, and more than half the parents know the Ryans and like 'em. So that crapped out in a hurry. You know what the only real problem is?
What's that, Don?
He smiled. At that age, sometimes I turn around and the kids move, and when I turn back I can't tell which one Sandbox is. You know there's only two kinds of haircuts for little girls, and half the mothers there think Oshkosh is the only brand of kids' clothes.
Don, it's a woman thing, Wendy Merritt observed. If the first toddler wears it, it has to be fashionable.
Probably the same thing with the hair, Andrea added. By the way, I forgot to tell you, Pat O'Day wants a little match with you, she told the details most senior member.
The bureau guy? Russell's eyes lit up.
Where?
When?
Tell him to bring money, Andrea.
It occurred to Russell that he was due to have some playtime of his own. He hadn't lost a pistol match in 7 years, his last bout with the flu.
We all set? Price asked her senior agents.
How's the boss doing? Altman asked.
They're keeping him pretty busy, cutting into his sleep time.
Want me to talk to Surgeon about it? She keeps a good eye on him, Roy told her.
Well, I know how.
Gee, Dr. Ryan, is the boss doing okay? He looked a little tired this morning, Altman suggested.
The four agents exchanged looks. President management was their most delicate duty. This president listened to his wife almost as though he were a normal husband. So why not make Surgeon into an ally? All four nodded at once.
Go with it, Price told him.
Son of a bitch, Colonel Ham said inside his command track.
Surprised you, did they? General Diggs inquired delicately.
They have a ringer in there, the CO of the Black Horse Cav wanted to know.
No, but they sprung one on me, Al. They didn't let anybody know they had Ivis training.
Well, that is, I found out last night.
Nice guy, sir.
Surprises work both ways, Colonel, Diggs reminded him.
How the hell did they get the funding for that?
They're fairy god senators, I suppose.
Visiting units didn't bring their own equipment to Fort Irwin, for the obvious reason that it was too expensive to transport it all back and forth. Instead, they mated up with vehicle sets permanent to the base, and those were top of the line. Included in all of them was IVIS, the Inter-Vehicle Information System, a battlefield data link that projected data onto a computer screen inside the tanks and Bradleys. It was something the 11th Cav had been issued for only its own vehicles, their real ones, not the simulated enemy sets, 6 months earlier. Seemingly a simple system for trading data, it even ordered spare parts automatically when something broke. It presented the crew with a comprehensive overview of the battlefield, and converted hard-won reconnaissance information into general knowledge in a matter of seconds. No longer was data on a developing engagement limited to a harried and distracted unit commander. Now sergeants knew everything the colonel did, and information was still the most valuable commodity known to man. The visiting tankers from the Carolina Guard were fully trained up on its use. So were the troopers of the Black Horse, but their pseudo-Soviet Op-4 vehicles didn't have it.
Colonel, now we really know how good the system is. It beat you.
The simulated engagement had been a bloody one. Ham and his operations officer had contrived a devilish ambush,
only to have the weekend warriors detect it, avoid it, and enter into a battle of maneuver which had caught the op for leaning the wrong way. A daring counterstroke by one of his squadron commanders had almost saved the day, and killed off half of the Blue Force, but it hadn't been enough.